I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short. Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear the second part of an interview between author Rebecca Roth and radio show host Henrik Palmgren of redicradio.net out of Sweden. It's been edited slightly to fit in our time frame. Rebecca Roth is a retired flight attendant, international purser, a volunteer firefighter, and has been trained as an emergency medical technician. Her book, Methodical Illusion, came out this past year and was number one on Amazon for historical fiction. The book deals with 9/11 from a flight attendant's perspective. Since writing the book, many people in the airline industry have contacted her and shared experiences and information. So she has new information that you don't want to miss about what happened. And she's done many, many interviews, and you can access some of them by going to YouTube and searching Rebecca Roth. The second edition of her book, Methodical Illusion, is already available. The second part of the interview starts here with a question from radio show host Henrik Palmgren.
Now, let me ask you a bit more about the flight attendants and their part in this then, if they knew what was going on. Because one thing that always comes up with me when we talk about these false flags and sting operations and people are dragged into things, sometimes knowingly, sometimes they don't know what's going on, etc. But in this case, I'm always curious as to why allow, do you think, some of these mistakes? Were they made at the time and they were not intended to be made, but there you go, there they are? Or is there another reason for that?
I've had lots of people from American Airlines come forward and talk to me on the phone and through emails. And most of them knew the crew members involved, both the pilots and the flight attendants. And this is what we've came up with. Remember, on 9/11, there were several military war games going on that day with the U.S. military. And we believe that what more than likely happened, there were not Arab hijackers on any of the manifests. So the real manifest, not the cooked up, made up stuff that the FBI has been lying about, but the real manifest didn't have Arab names on them. Those hijackers were not listed as passengers. So the handlers that came on, we believe, and I'll tell you in a little bit how the planes were taken over remotely, what was used to do that. The aircraft were actually equipped with a device that was sold to some commercial carriers in the United States, not all of them. Listen carefully to how it was sold. Quote, in the event that a hijacker took over control of the cockpit, we could land the aircraft remotely. And there it will be liberated by the Army Rangers, Navy SEALs, or whoever was nearby to liberate the plane and the passengers. So now you're probably wondering, well, then if they had that on board, why didn't they use it? Because certainly on 9/11, we had four airplanes where we are led to believe that hijackers had actually taken over the cockpit, right? Well, they didn't use that because it was already in use. And when the flight termination system, or one of the airlines actually referred to it as the flight interruption system, this is very interesting because the CEO of the company that created the flight termination system, it's the same system that we run our drones around the world in, using this flight termination system software. That's how we can sit in Nevada and guys can fly our Predator drones and the like in Afghanistan and Pakistan and all those places where we're bombing wedding parties and elementary schools. So that's how they work. And the interesting thing about that, it's created by a company called SPC, like Sam, Paul, Charlie, SPC Corporation. The CEO of that company was also the comptroller of the United States Pentagon, Rabbi Dov Zakheim. Rabbi Dov Zakheim was, at the time of 9/11, involved in an investigation where the Pentagon had misplaced $2.3 trillion with a T, United States dollars. And so he's very connected to a lot of other things. What I found about this rabbi, he's a dual citizen with Israel and the United States. Somehow he managed to become the comptroller of the United States Pentagon. SPC had a subsidiary company called TriData. And after the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, if you'll recall, his company TriData got the blueprints for both the North and South Tower. Very convenient. And then he also is involved with another group, a consortium of people. And they have another interesting company that refurbishes commercial 767s and turns them into military refueling tankers and sells them to military around the world.
I just want to mention that if this had been any other nationality of dual citizens and what have you, this would be immediately, it wouldn't be allowed to begin with, but it would be immediately out in the open. But it's not on this case for some reason. It's hushed up, covered up, and no one is mentioning about it. And as you say, if you bring it up, well, you're an anti-Semite, right? So
yes, and just much like that person who questioned Building 7 falling down. And so one of the things that I made my decision when I decided I would do interviews after the book came out and talk about what I did find is that I'm going to tell you the truth. I don't care whose religion it offends, and you can call me all the names you want, because the truth is going to stand, and I'm going to stand in it. And the truth is the only thing that'll set us free and lift the veil of lies that the media, very, very controlled media, has been covering up for over a decade. And on behalf of the flight crews that perished and the passengers on those planes and every person that died in those towers, I'm going to stand here and shout the truth from the rooftops until they take me out with a drone strike or worse.
Very good.
I have no fear of them. So let me tell you a little bit about that flight termination system, because this is really important that people understand. The flight termination system ran on a frequency, much like the transponder. And so when the flight termination system took over the aircraft, and this is why a lot of the pilots in the United States Airline Pilots Association did not want this ever to be put on their planes, they lost all communication. It was an override system that overrided all communication, including being able to speak to the flight attendants in the cabin. Keep in mind that the cockpit door only has a little tiny peek hole, and we are their eyes and ears. If they don't hear from us, they don't think anything's going on. If the airplane is on fire in the tail section or in the cabin, they don't know about it until we phone them. So nobody wants to lose communication with their eyes and ears, and they didn't. And so only some of the airlines actually bought those. And just another interesting thing your listeners can look up, and readers, if you'd blog this too, is that Boeing actually got caught putting the flight termination system on a Lufthansa aircraft, maybe more than one, and also for a Chinese aircraft. They were Boeing aircraft that they took delivery of, and they discovered the flight termination system, which is basically like a plug-in device into the flight computer. And that flight computer sits between the captain and the co-pilot on the floor. So I say it's about as easy as putting a USB port in your laptops. That's how easy it is. And so they actually, when they discovered that, they sued the Boeing company, because that meant that anybody sitting in the United States could actually key in to an aircraft. And now I bet you're thinking about MH370, because everyone's mind goes there, because mine did. And by the way, MH370 had just enough fuel on board to go to Diego Garcia, which is a big drone base. And these aircraft can be taken over by an AWACS aircraft, or just about anybody that's running a drone base out of Diego Garcia could have done that. The 7th Fleet was in a drill that day in the South China Sea as well. So pretty sure that's what happened. There were some people on board that had some information that somebody's government wanted, whether it was us or Israel or the UK. It's a joint drone base, actually, with the United States and Great Britain. It's Diego Garcia.
But that's a huge security risk. You talked about that, of having the ability to a termination system like that and transponders on the plane, which is, of course, would be, you'd think, dragged up into the open, and investigations would have to be made here to see that no other planes has these kinds of issues. But we've heard nothing about this.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the companies that bought into it did so willingly because they were sold in the event that a hijacker took over the cockpit, we can land the plane remotely. Well, so what happens, the planes on 9/11 were taken over remotely by using the flight termination system. Since then, in 2006 or 2008, Boeing has come up with their own patent for their own device to do this, and George W. Bush made it mandatory that it's on all U.S. carriers. I don't know what's going on with the U.K. or EU or those European governments, but you could look into that in your country. But yeah, Boeing has a new system that took the place of the flight termination system, does the same thing. And I'm being told that eventually air traffic controllers will be able to control the aircraft and land them somewhere from the actual air traffic control centers. So my question was, when they said, we can remotely land the aircraft, I said, who are we? Yeah. Right? I never got an answer to that. Well, who would we be? Because who are those people that could actually land the aircraft? Well, I think we figured it out on 9/11. So what we have here on 9/11, again, one of the first things that Betty Ong, she's the flight attendant from Flight 11, said is, we can't call the cockpit. We can't communicate with the cockpit. And that, again, showed me that the flight termination system had taken over. When it does that, the air traffic controllers lose the transponder on radar. It takes over the same frequency that the transponder used. And it also, it sort of piggybacks over all communication systems. So the pilots cannot communicate with the company, the air traffic control, or other airplanes using any radio frequency that they have. So that's basically what was going on. And one of the reasons the flight attendants, including Betty Ong, who said, I don't know, but we might be being hijacked. When there's a hijacker on board, you know it. He's usually standing in the aisle, and he's usually with a flight attendant that he's got a box cutter, a knife, or a gun, or a bomb, or, and he's making a demand. Yeah. I want X, Y, and Z to happen. And so there is no doubt. And when she said, I don't know, that told me a lot. And then it told me also that it wasn't a typical hijacking. We might be being hijacked, is exactly what she said. And so, again, I heard her tell me a clue that she didn't know. And if you are in a hijacking, you know about it. And there was something else that I found later on in Betty Ong said this as well, but a lot of the callers did. They said, we're in the air. And I think that they said that because, of course, a hijacking only takes place in the air. If somebody came on board when you were at the terminal on the tarmac, at the gate area, or even taxiing out and said, I want to hijack this airplane. I want blah, blah, blah. You just blow a chute and get all the people out. And so there is no hijacking on the ground. Of course, hijacking only takes place in the air. And the fact that she said that, it made me realize that a lot of the other callers were saying that too. And they were trying to convince us that they were, in fact, in the air when they were in a hangar.
And so they were knowingly saying this, and they were talking, they knew that they were.
Yes.
So that means, that implies, of course, that they're part of it. And then back to my original question on that, why make these mistakes along the way?
What we believe, and collectively, and we, the American flight attendants and pilots that have come forward, we've had some great chats about this. We believe that the handlers told the pilots and the flight attendant crew that they were part of a training drill. And that you'll notice that until you get to Flight 93, just two people were taken off each aircraft. And I believe they were removed. And when Betty Ong says there was pepper spray or mace sprayed, there was some other gas sprayed. And I think when they removed the people to make the phone calls, which was two off of each aircraft until Flight 93, they were taken upstairs to an office, and that Betty Ong and Amy Sweeney were actually sitting in different rooms. And that's why one was saying that a doctor and a nurse were tending to 9B who had been stabbed. And the other one was saying there was no doctor or nurse on board. And so there were so many things about those two flight attendants, because they were flight attendants and because they didn't say the most important thing that they could have said had they made a phone call. And that would have been how somebody got into the cockpit, because that's what we would have prevented and fixed in the future. And that's how the FAA functioned. If you got in by kicking the doorknob in, then that would be the important thing for them to say. And if you got in by using a credit card to swipe the lock or something, there has to be a method. How did they get in? How they got into the cockpit was really the only important information. And neither one of them gave that information. They gave us that 9B was the hijacker. Then they gave us that 9B was stabbed. And then they said conflicting things. Betty Ong said she was seated at the jump seat in 3R. Amy Sweeney said they were seated together in the second to the last row in coach. And so their messages were completely conflicting, which made me realize that they had been removed from the aircraft. And when they removed the two callers that were necessary to make phone calls, because without the phone calls, we wouldn't have any wars going on right now. The phone calls were the most important for the perpetrators of this event. And so the things that they said, now, I've been around for a long time. I was a flight attendant for almost 30 years and a purser. And when I flew to places like Amsterdam, which was a big hub from the Europe and the rest of the world into the United States, we'd often have more than 60 languages being spoken. And one of the terminologies that both the passengers and the flight attendants said was they used the terminology, the hijackers were of Middle Eastern descent, and nobody talks like that. And I was like, okay, they're reading this, or they were told what to say. And so I think what happened is, to answer your question, that the aircraft were brought into these hangars at this area. The handlers picked you and you, which in this case was on flight 11, the two flight attendants, you and you, come with me. The gas that they referred to, that neither one of them had a breathing problem in a 27-minute phone call. And gas being sprayed in business class was one of the very first things Betty Ong reported at about 8:19, the very first minute of her call. They took them off into two different offices where they were told to make these phone calls. And more than likely, a cyanide gas canister was thrown in and the door was shut and the people on the aircraft were killed within 3 to 4 minutes. Well, I think what they were told was it's a drill, and then we want you to come and make some phone calls. They pulled them into the offices, and at that point, they were probably a gunshot. They were definitely taken out. They were not part of this. I've got lots of people that were friends with a lot of the crew members. I can't find anybody that looks like they might have been a part of being a handler or being a part of the organization that pulled it off. But we think the only reason that the pilots, because you see, all eight of the pilots were highly trained fighter pilots, military pilots. And what we do when we put our uniform on, we're there for one thing. That's to keep you safe. Whether we're pilot or flight attendant, we change from being a mom and a sister and a lady next door to being one kick-ass protector of our plane and our passengers. And that's what we do. That's what we drill to do. That's what we are. And the fact that the scenarios that led later on into like Flight 93 were led to believe that the flight attendants did nothing and that they allowed a group of men, by the way, all of those men, the Let's Roll character and the other guys, they all were sitting in different rows of coach talking on the phone up until the minute they claimed the scenario goes that they were going to take over the plane by rushing the cockpit with hot water and coffee pots full of hot water. Well, let me just say this. One, no flight attendant group crew would ever give control in any emergency to untrained passengers. That's what we trained for. We had specific protocols to follow. And so all of them, by the way, were on the phone up until 1 minute before this supposed rush the cockpit. Number two, the aircraft between the captain and the co-pilot is about 2 by 2 foot square box, which is the onboard flight computer, what that flight termination system would be plugged into. And it is water sensitive, much like a laptop keyboard. And so when we would hand the captain a cup of coffee, for example, we would have to hand it off over his left shoulder and tell him it's coming in. We would just say, "Captain, your beverage is coming over your left shoulder," where he would turn around and grab it. If we put it over that computer and handed a drink or a beverage, and he turned around and hit it with the elbow, or we hit some turbulence and even a tablespoon of liquid bounced onto that computer, then it would not be a pretty picture. So it's something that all flight attendants are trained not to do. And so the fact that we are led to believe that five flight attendants on a 757 would allow four passengers that didn't even know each other to rush into the cockpit, somehow break the door down and take four pots of hot water or coffee in there over that computer is nonsense. Just complete total nonsense. So these are the kind of things that I saw. And then as I got in there, and now this leads us to these companies, what happens when the flight termination system takes over? And I told you the transponder, this is how the FAA and air traffic control see the plane in the sky. They see that it's American 11. They see the altitude. They see the speed. They see all these different things on these radar screens. Well, as I dug into this, I've discovered there were two companies that were in the FAA headquarters in Washington, D.C. for 2 years leading up to 9/11. And one of them was called PTEC, and one of them was called the MITRE, M-I-T-R-E. And interesting things that I'm still discovering to this day about both of those companies. What they were doing, they were actually there to make things appear and disappear on radar for the war games that were going on that day, so that FAA could not see what NORAD showed on their military jets and the NORAD military radar.
So they could simulate it. So basically what was shown to those who are looking at the screens, they think it's real. They think, oh, that this is what's going on, that they're simply reporting on what they see, correct?
That's correct. Yeah. And so they were able to, once the flight termination system took over these four aircraft, they were able to not only make them completely disappear off the screens, but they were able to replace them with a fake scenario of what they wanted you to believe those planes did after they were landed remotely. And so they have a scenario created which they just uploaded into the computer system. And then later on, they showed you, well, these are the flight paths those planes took. And they even made animated GIF type photos of, you could see the planes moving. And they claimed that Flight 11 and Flight 175 were in a near miss, nearly a collision down by Stewart Air Force Base. But one of the things that's happened since the book came out is I've been privy to and given an external hard drive with a terabyte of FAA and NORAD information, and their official story, it does not exist on radar in text format. So those aircraft actually were not anywhere near Stewart Air Force Base at that time they were claiming. So we're finding some really interesting things, and I'm hoping that it's enough to get the attention of some really big people. Maybe my drone strike. Actually, I'm not the only person. I'm working with a group of people, so they can't silence it. But so what I discovered were these companies, and interestingly enough, that after I did the book, I still kept diving into who the handlers on board might have been. And so I'm looking into those details of those phone calls. And it's very interesting because on the next flight, which also left out of Boston, there were two characters that made phone calls at 8:52. Now, the flight left at 8:14. So at 8:52, interestingly enough, two people, again, just like on Flight 11, at the very exact time the calls were both made, again on Flight 175, at 8:52. And then again at 9 o'clock, there were gentlemen, Peter Hansen, 32-year-old gentleman, passenger, and he calls in at 8:52, and he calls his dad, and he tells his father that an airline hostess had been stabbed. And an airline hostess is not terminology that's ever been used in the United States to talk about a stewardess or a flight attendant, ever. It's a European term, and it's a Middle Eastern term. El Al calls their flight attendants airline hostess. Some Asian companies do. I mean, remember being in Japan and China and being referred to as an airline hostess by a Japanese girl. But it's not an American terminology. We were stewardesses until 1968. And then we became flight attendants because we started hiring so many males in that position. So this guy is, by the way, he is American. He's 32. So his entire lifetime, we have been referred to as a stewardess or a flight attendant. So that was another key that I thought that he either was told to say that or was reading off a card to say that, because it's not terminology that is normally used by an American. But he tells his father at 8:52 that he thinks the hijackers are going to fly them to Chicago, where they will be flown into a building. And prior to 9/11, unless you'd been told the scenario before that phone call, you would never have dreamed that scenario. Then again, he calls his father back at 9 o'clock, exactly 3 minutes before impact, to the South Tower in Manhattan. So 3 minutes before that plane went in, you would know you were over New York City. There's no doubt about it. And so he tells his dad now, this time, the stewardess has been stabbed, and that uses the word stewardess. And then he says that they've used pepper spray or mace and that people around him are vomiting and getting sick. And so I thought, well, that's really interesting, because you don't really get sick and vomit from pepper spray or mace, but you do from hydrogen cyanide. So that kind of told me something. And now on that same call, there was another gentleman that at first I overlooked this totally. But it's interesting that he calls his mother, first his wife, leaves a call message on her home recorder, then calls his mom at 9 o'clock. This is 3 minutes before impact. Now, keep in mind, New York City is something like 365 square miles. It's huge. So when you're over Manhattan or over New York City, you know where you're at, because it flows into Newark and all of these. It's just huge. And so if you were a pilot, this guy was an F-14 pilot, which is why I at first overlooked him as being a handler. But he tells his mother at 9 o'clock, 3 minutes before impact, that they're over Ohio, he thinks. Now, he's a pilot, so he should be able to tell Manhattan from rural Ohio. And 3 minutes before impact, he would definitely be seeing buildings in New York. So then he also tells his mother that they are thinking, this is now 8 minutes after supposedly the hijacking took place, they, the passengers, are thinking about taking over the cockpit. And that's the scenario from Flight 93 with the hot water. And then I realized that this guy, he also had been told of the scenario. We have Betty Ong saying, we're the first, and she was on the first plane. Then we have Peter Hansen and Brian Sweeney from Flight 175 saying they're going to fly us into a buildings in Chicago, and then we're going to take over the cockpit. And then I realized right then and there that some of these people had definitely been told the entire day scenario, which leads me to answer your question. The people that made these phone calls were told, and the passengers and crew were told, they were part of a drill and this was the scenario, and they laid it out for them, and that's the only way they knew those details. However, as I kept digging into Brian Sweeney, his friends in Miramar Top Gun, he's a Top Gun fighter pilot, F-14 fighter pilot, all of his friends, much like 9B, all of his friends said he was 6'2", 225 pounds, he could kill any human being with his bare hands. Why he didn't is the question of the day. As I was researching him after my book came out, I actually was in his online obituaries, and about, as I'm reading through this, a 15 or so obituary comments that people made to his obituary said, "I remember you, Brian, from the M cafeteria in the months preceding 9/11 when we worked for the MITRE company, which is one of the companies that we just talked about that was able to make things appear and disappear on radar. And that is basically the shadow government of the United States. And I would venture to say they're in control of most of the world."
And here Rebecca tells you about her website and where you can get a copy of her book.
The website is simply www.methodicalillusion.com. And there you can do a look inside and read the first almost three chapters of the book. You can purchase it through any bookstore that can order a book for you. It's in the Ingram list, so it takes about 5 to 7 days to order it if you have a local bookstore you like to visit. I'm available to answer any questions. If you read the book and you want to know, do I have documents to prove this or that, or what's real or what's not, I welcome your questions and will help you proceed in your wake up if you're just having that veil lifted. The thing that I found that's interesting about 9/11, since I was in cognitive dissonance like a lot of people are, and I didn't want to look at it, but once I did, once the veil of 9/11 truth is lifted, you begin to see things like what we just saw happen in Copenhagen and in Paris with the Charlie Hebdo event, and you'll start to see things that are the same type of things. Like on 9/11, we had 2 passports survive, but nothing else. No luggage, no landing gear, no hydraulics, no nothing of the aircraft but a passport from a hijacker, not from any other passenger, but just the hijacker. And then after the towers, there was one of their passports survived as well in pretty darn good condition. So you'll see in Charlie Hebdo, they also left the driver's license behind in one of the carjacked stolen cars. Mm-hmm. So you'll see the same type of details so that we know who to hate. And that's why the phone calls had to be made on 9/11. They needed to paint the picture of Middle Eastern so that we could go and fight in all those wars that they had planned when they planned and wrote the project for the new American century, which actually called for a new Pearl Harbor event to get the American people on board to go do these 7 or more wars in the Middle East.
And again, you were just listening to an interview with Rebecca Roth, author of the book Methodical Illusion. She was being interviewed by Henrik Palmgren from RedIceRadio.net. I also interviewed Rebecca Roth back in the winter, and that show is available on the website RadioForAll.net. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.